Welcome to the Federalist Society's Courthouse Steps podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Religious Liberties Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, November 6, 2013, during a live teleform conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Practice Group's teleform conference call. On today's call, we'll be discussing yet another case argued in the Supreme Court this week, Town of Greece versus Galloway. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that, as always, all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, we're recording today's call for possible use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome on our call today our expert, Ms. Kim Colby. She is Senior Counsel at the Christian Legal Society. Her bio is in your inbox, so I'm brief with my introductions. She attended oral argument. She's going to give us some, in her opening remarks, some background on the case, then talk about the argument, and then go from there. And as always, we will be turning to you for questions from the audience, so please make sure you have your questions ready. And with that, Ms. Colby, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dean, and thank you for this opportunity to discuss what's likely to be an important decision by the Supreme Court. It was a fascinating argument this morning, and the three attorneys who presented oral argument were all excellent: Tom Hungar, the Assistant Solicitor General, and Doug Laycock. So it was a top-rate argument before the court this morning. I'd like to just quickly go back over a few of the three cases that feed into the case before the court today: Marsh versus Chambers, Allegheny County versus ACLU, and Levy-Weissman. And I'm going to just hit the highlights of those cases and then just very briefly summarize the parties' main arguments and then turn to the highlights of this morning's discussion. So I think, as most people know, really, the issue before the court, to some degree, is whether the court is going to retain Marsh versus Chambers, which was decided 30 years ago when the Supreme Court held that the Establishment Clause was not violated by a state legislature paying a chaplain to pray at the opening of its daily sessions. And it's really interesting, in rereading Marsh this weekend, I was just struck by how much the arguments in the majority opinion by Chief Justice Berger that upheld the Nebraska chaplaincy, how much those arguments parallel the arguments of the town and the Solicitor General today, and how much the arguments of Justice Brennan in dissent to some degree parallel the arguments of the respondents. And for ease, I'm going to refer to the respondents just by Ms. Galloway. There are two respondents, two challengers to the town's prayer practice, Ms. Galloway and Ms. Stevens, but I'll just refer to them by Galloway. Just to refresh on Marsh, the facts were straightforward in that case. For 16 years, the Nebraska legislature had paid the same Presbyterian minister to open its daily legislative sessions with prayer. And a member of the legislature challenged the practice as a violation of the Establishment Clause, relying on the fact that the first Congress had, in the same week, drafted the Establishment Clause and the rest of the First Amendment and sent it off to the states for ratification, and in the same week had then passed legislation to appoint and pay chaplains, relying on what the first Congress had done, the Supreme Court in 1983 in Marsh said that the Nebraska chaplaincy was constitutional because it was part of the fabric of our society, given that not only Congress but state legislatures and other deliberative bodies had been opening with invocations for over 200 years. The court specifically looked at three aspects of the Nebraska chaplaincy to see whether they individually violated the Establishment Clause. The first factor was that a chaplain from one denomination, one chaplain who happened to be Presbyterian, had served for 16 years. The court said that that did not violate the Establishment Clause unless there was some sort of proof of an impermissible motive in selecting the chaplain. Second, the court said said that the fact that the chaplain was paid with public funds was not a problem because that's what the First Congress had voted to allow for its chaplains. And third, the court said that the content of the prayers, which was conceded to be Judeo-Christian, was not a problem. Because it's a theme that runs throughout the Greece briefing, it's worth quoting the court on the content of prayers, because this has sort of become the main holding of Marsh, the test, if you will, that people have drawn from Marsh. The court said that the content of the prayer is not of concern to judges, whereas here there is no indication that the prayer opportunity has been exploited to proselytize or advance any one or to disparage any other faith or belief. And that being so, the court continued, it is not for us to embark on a sensitive evaluation or to parse the content of a particular prayer. So coming out of Marsh, the main things that lower courts have taken when they've had challenges to legislative prayer since Marsh, they've looked to see whether there's an impermissible motive in selecting the chaplain, and that was not at issue here. Initially, the respondents had challenged that in the district court, but they dropped that challenge on appeal and conceded that there had not been intentional discrimination in choosing the prayer givers in the town of Greece. Second, Marsh stands for this idea that prayers should not proselytize, advance, or disparage other faiths or beliefs, but that they can be have sectarian content. And then finally, Marsh stands for the idea that courts should not be parsing the content of the prayers. The other two cases that just need to be noted is, one is the Allegheny case, which came about 6 years after Marsh. It was the infamous case in which the Supreme Court held that a creche inside a courthouse violated the Establishment Clause because it did not have any secular content around it, but that a menorah and a Christmas tree on the courthouse lawn did not violate the Establishment Clause. In a couple sentences in that case, the court majority had seemed arguably to suggest that Marsh only meant that non-sectarian prayer was permissible and that it had not approved of sectarian prayer. And that is a big part of the argument of the respondents in this case, although Allegheny was hardly mentioned during the oral argument. The third case besides Allegheny and Marsh is Levy-Wiseman, of course, because in 1992, the Supreme Court had before it the practice of graduation prayer. And Justice Kennedy authored that opinion using a coercion test rather than endorsement, but unexpectedly finding that there was coercion in a graduation ceremony, and therefore many graduation prayers were unconstitutional. The other main importance of Levy-Wiseman was that in coming to this conclusion that the school district in Levy-Wiseman had violated the Establishment Clause, Justice Kennedy relied heavily on the fact that the school district had provided guidelines to the rabbi who had given the graduation invocation and benediction. And for Justice Kennedy, this provision of guidelines was actually the government helping write the prayers, which to Justice Kennedy is something that government should never be engaged in. So that part of Levy-Wiseman that is very skeptical on the part of Justice Kennedy of guidelines for prayers came up quite often in today's oral argument. Now, turning to the facts of this case, of course, there have been numerous cases in the lower courts in which legislative prayers by deliberative bodies have been challenged since Marsh. A couple of times it has been challenges to state legislatures. For example, there was one in Indiana, Hendricks versus Bozeman, about 10 years ago. And in town of Greece, what we see is a town is governed. It's about a suburb of Rochester, New York. It's about 100,000 people. And it's governed by a board of five supervisors who meet on a monthly basis. Until 1999, their meetings opened with a moment of silence, but beginning in 1999, they began to have an invocation by a volunteer resident. There is no written policy setting forth how this is to be done, but their practice has been to compile a list of potential prayer givers by taking a list of religious organizations from the Chamber of Commerce Community Guide. A town employee would then call people to see if they would volunteer to come and give the prayer. And if they did, they put the volunteer's name on the list and then went through the list when it was time to get someone to pray for the monthly meeting. The prayer occurs early in the meeting. It comes after the opening with the Pledge of Allegiance, then the prayer. After that comes usually a swearing-in ceremony for town employees and a time to honor any citizens who are being honored, and then a public forum during which time any resident can get up and speak, and then it's followed by the business part of the meeting, which is zoning permits, business permits, and other town matters. The town asserts that any resident is free to volunteer to put her name on the list to be a prayer giver. Until litigation in this case, all of the prayer givers had been Christians, and sometimes the prayers had uniquely Christian references. Around the time of the lawsuit, there were representatives from the Jewish, the Baha'i, and the Wiccan faiths who gave prayers during the 2008-2010 time period. The town won on cross motions for summary judgment in the district court, and then it lost in the Second Circuit, which agreed that there was no impermissible motivation for the choice of the prayer givers, and that the prayers themselves, their content, did not violate the Marsh test. They didn't proselytize, advance, or disparage any religion. But the Second Circuit then added the Allegheny dicta, which basically the Second Circuit said, but we think that a reasonable observer would nonetheless see the town affiliating itself with Christianity, and this is therefore a violation of the Establishment Clause because there's just too much Christian reference and too many Christian speakers, basically. But it's a very murky test. The Second Circuit did not strike down all legislative prayers, but it did say it was going to be very difficult for any town to come up with an acceptable practice. Just very briefly, the town's main arguments are history, that we have an unambiguous and unbroken history of legislative prayer at all levels of government, federal, state, and local, and by all three branches of the federal government, including congressional chaplains, inaugural prayers, and court sessions opening, as the court did today, with God Save the United States and this honorable court. Besides wrapping itself in Marsh, it actually claimed that it was less difficult a case than Marsh because it did not pay the school volunteer or the prayer volunteers. And then finally, the town asked for basically a broader win. It was going for a repudiation of the lemon and endorsement tests and suggesting a coercion test instead. The United States came in with a very strong brief in support of the town and had 10 minutes of the oral argument time this morning. Their main arguments are twofold, again, the history and Marsh, and then secondly, the real danger in the government's view of having courts or legislatures parse the content of prayers, that is really a wrong road to go down, and therefore the prayer should just be given under the Marsh standard of not proselytizing, disparaging, or advancing. And then, of course, lurking in both briefs are, if this prayer is not constitutional, what does that do to the national motto, to the Pledge of Allegiance, and to other public acknowledgments of religion? To turning just very quickly to the respondents' arguments, they are very much, their brief seems to be very much going for a Lee versus Weissman type of win. They claim that, of course, government can never coerce people to engage in a religious activity, but that that is exactly what is happening when town residents, in order to attend a town board meeting, have to stand or sit through a prayer before they can engage in business before their town government. The briefing also put a heavy emphasis on the fact that children often attended, because that had been such a heavy factor in the Levy-Weissman decision. And they put a heavy emphasis on, even if coercion is the test, these people are being coerced into a religious activity. The brief, I think, for the respondents was very interesting because the first 47 pages of the brief is a very strong case of this is coercion and it violates the Establishment Clause. But on page 48, the respondents say, but we actually don't think you will strike down legislative prayers. And so we're going to ask you to ameliorate the coercion, that's their words, and sort of fix it so it's less coercive. And the best way to do that, according to the respondents, is to implement a sectarian, non-sectarian test so that only non-sectarian prayers would be allowed in this context. I think I'll turn now to what the court said this morning and how some of these arguments played out. There are just about five main themes in the argument this morning. Justice Kagan dominated the oral argument, which I think is probably what will be happening in future Religion Clause cases. She barely let Tom Hunger finish a sentence before she interrupted, or not interrupted, but began to question, with a hypothetical that she took a prayer that had been given in Greece that was highly loaded with Christian discussion of Easter. And she took that prayer and asked whether the court that morning could have begun its session with a minister asking the people assembled to rise and listen to this prayer. And that hypothetical basically became the theme for the oral argument. Hunger said that there was a difference between the judiciary and legislatures for purposes of prayer, and that there was also a lack of history for that kind of prayer. The lines that developed from the question were basically, is there a difference between what's permissible for legislative prayers and what's permissible in the courtroom? And at some point, Scalia begins to talk about the fact that legislators are actually still acting as citizens, whereas judges, of course, are acting as government officials. There was also a little discussion about the line between God Save the Court and the prayer in Kagan's hypothetical. Chief Justice Roberts asked whether the hypothetical depended on whether the people assembled in the courtroom were asked to stand for the prayer. But that opening volley, as you will, from Justice Kagan really did set the tone for the town's argument. One other main argument that respondents had made that came up in this context of judiciary versus prayer, and it was a main theme of the argument, is whether there's a difference between legislative prayer for state legislatures and Congress where the public is not participating in the activity. The public is there as onlookers to the debates, whereas at a town board meeting, the public is there as participants as well. And the town board is sitting not just as a legislature, but also as some sort of adjudicatory body because of these zoning permits and business permits and so on. And so the respondents put a very heavy emphasis during the argument and in their briefs on the fact that people were being asked to stand for prayer by the very people that in a few minutes would be deciding whether they got their petition for a zoning permit or a business permit. And this was a big theme of this morning's discussion. Kagan, Sotomayor, and Ginsburg all pushed very hard on the adjudicatory aspect of a town meeting. Another theme or question was whether history alone was enough support for legislative prayer being held constitutional. And both Chief Justice Roberts voiced the question of whether, for example, would In God We Trust be put on our coins today, and did that matter, whether this was something done a long time ago and not just done today, whereas Scalia said, you know, if it was constitutional now, why wasn't it constitutional then? The other thing that came forward in the argument, a main theme, was no one except possibly Justice Breyer seemed at all happy with respondents' asking the court to put out a rule where government officials would be deciding whether a prayer was sectarian or non-sectarian. Most of them did not seem to think that was a very workable standard. And the main questions were, who makes the determination as to whether the prayer is sectarian or non-sectarian? And can everyone be made happy by a non-sectarian prayer? And at some point, Alito pushed very hard for Professor Laycock to give an example of a non-sectarian prayer. Professor Laycock offered some, but Alito was not satisfied, nor was it seemed Kennedy, Roberts, or Scalia. And eventually, the respondents were basically backed into a corner of agreeing that no prayer would make everyone happy, but that many people could be made happy by one prayer. But then, of course, Scalia leaps in and says, so who are we going to offend, the Baha'is, the atheists, that kind of thing. Laycock's main answer was to look to the Fourth Circuit, which is applying this sort of standard through four different legislative prayers that have come down in the last 10 years. But bottom line was, I want to look at Kennedy and Breyer before we open for questions. Just the bottom line was, Kennedy in the end, on one hand, he was saying aloud that this seemed to be a practice in which the government was heavily involved in religion. On the other hand, he was very troubled that the respondents were asking for basically what he sees to be government censorship of prayer or editing of prayer. He said maybe that means there should be no prayer, but then he seemed to say, but that's not who we are as a people. He also voiced some discomfort as that it would be elitist to allow the state and national governments to have prayer, but not the local governments. Justice Breyer, and I'll conclude with this, offered, he spent the whole oral argument trying to fix the problem, and his fix sounded very much like what the Second Circuit had suggested, so I don't know that there were many takers for it, but his fix was twofold, that the town should cast a broader net for prayer givers, and that the town should give them guidelines so that the prayers themselves would be more inclusive. Laycock pushed back and said that the rotation idea doesn't work for town meetings because people only come to one or two. They don't come to that many. And at the very end, Kennedy seemed to say to Breyer, that would make a great concurring opinion. So with that somewhat enigmatic remark, I'll close my remarks and we can open for questions.
Thank you very much. Let's now open the floor to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for our expert today, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for our expert, Ms. Kim Colby, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And while we're waiting to see who rings in, let me make our usual programming announcement. Tomorrow at noon, we will have a special book teleforum with author Peter Schweitzer, and Lee O'Connor discussing his new book. And then on Friday, at again a special early time, 11 a.m. Eastern Time, we'll have yet another Courthouse Steps edition of teleforum. This one taking a look at the Medtronic intellectual property case that was argued this week in the Supreme Court. Right now we have two callers with questions. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our first caller.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. It seems that there may be a way to split the baby in this case by recognizing, as it was suggested in Levy Schweizman and by Justice Scalia, that we separate the gathering into at least three phases. The initial gathering, which is voluntary before anything is called to order. The second phase, we might call it an inquisitorial phase, during which the body meets as in a committee of the whole to hear petitions, but again, in which attendance is not mandatory. And then finally, a business meeting in which attendance is mandatory, in which there is debate and decision. Only in the last phase would, I think, an issue be raised of establishment. While it's in the initial gathering phase or in the committee of the whole phase, the lack of coercion then should be the test involved. I would say that wouldn't you agree, perhaps, that the way to decide this would be to say prayers are okay in the initial gathering before anything is called to order or during the inquisitorial phase, but not during the business phase?
I don't know if there would be enough votes for that position. It did, as I already said, and you're pointing out, I mean, something like that was discussed, not that specific, not a trimester approach, but more the idea of making sure that there was a lot of time between the time the prayer was given and the adjudication. I think that there would be some pushback on that idea from perhaps Justice Kennedy, and this may even go to his kind of concurring opinion remark at the end that maybe Breyer writes a concurrence that says ideas like you've put out, but that the court itself doesn't give that kind of limitations on the town councils. I also think that Scalia would argue that that kind of limit isn't placed upon state legislatures and Congress. I mean, I think it's sort of part of the Congress's first order of business, and that it might be a rule that kind of invites complaints or even litigation as to how much time needs to be given. But something similar to what you were talking about was bandied about and might show up in, for example, a Breyer concurrence.
We've got one caller question pending. Again, if you'd like to ask a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to the next caller.
Carl Esbeck. Thanks, Kim Colby. That was helpful. My question has to do with Justice Kagan, who, of course, is maybe the most interesting person, partly because she's the newest justice. Was her let me give you two extremes. Was her involvement in the argument, on the one hand, was she sort of sparring with all three advocates and giving all of them a hard time and sort of testing out their theories and the boundaries of their arguments? Or, on the other hand, was she herself taking an advocate's position and coming in strongly against the town of Greece based upon her hypotheticals and questions?
My read is that she was definitely taking the advocacy role. The latter part, I could be wrong, but I didn't feel that she, I think to the degree she had interchanges with Professor Laycock, they were in the manner of helping. But that said, she had a very interesting comment toward the end of the debate, or the oral argument, in which she just sort of seemed to say out loud to nobody in particular, maybe we just create more problems when we get involved in these types of cases, which I would never have expected a Harvard dean to say those words, that the course might create problems by becoming involved in the cases. But I just thought that was an interesting remark coming from her. So I do think she was definitely putting out a very strong hypothetical at the very beginning of the argument, intending to dominate the discussion. I think it was a hypothetical that was meant to be very difficult for the advocate, and it was very similar, actually, to a hypothetical that was given to the advocate in Levy Weissman for the school district. So I think, you know, we saw a little bit of an attempt to replay history there. It wasn't the same hypothetical, but sort of the same idea of a very strong question about, can the state endorse religion and where do you draw the line? And then the third thing I thought she was doing, and I Sotomayor, I think, sort of picked up on this too, was it was actually trying to get the people in the courtroom themselves to think of themselves in the position of Galloway. And so I think it, in that regard, it was also an exercise in trying to change minds of people just within the courtroom, which I found very interesting.
Kim, this is Dean Reuter. Anybody from the bench advocating for the other side, trying to ask some hard questions of Doug Laycock or maybe be helpful to Tom Hungar?
I think we definitely saw the Scalia, Alito, very much being helpful to Hungar and just very persistent in his questioning with Laycock. Alito, reasonably early in Laycock's argument, asked him for an example of a nonsectarian prayer that would be okay with Galloway. But that would truly be non-sectarian and would not offend other religions. And Laycock would respond, but then, you know, another justice would come in with a question. And Alito came back to this point at least three times, basically saying, you haven't yet really given me an answer that satisfies me. And that's how I think Laycock got backed into what I think was his toughest time during the argument, which is this idea that, well, yeah, you are going to have, you know, a non-sectarian prayer will still offend the atheists and maybe the polytheists, and that's okay. So that was due in large part to Justice Alito's questions.
Very good. We've got two callers with questions. Let's go to our next caller. Like we might have lost a caller. Again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got just one caller in the queue now, so our lines will be open shortly.
You know, Justice Thomas frequently, I know he didn't ask any questions from the bench, but he frequently writes dissents in these religious cases indicating, and I think that the train of thought is this, that the federal government needs to back its head out of this noose. And that where the First Amendment says Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion, that maybe this was an issue to be left to the states. Did you get the impression that Justice Kagan may have been agreeing with the idea that this is just not an area, creation of non-sectarian prayers that the federal court wants to insert itself in?
Well, that's certainly what her comments seem to suggest. I was surprised that it was coming from her. But I do think there's some grounds for thinking that for her maybe coming to that conclusion, or at least perhaps thinking that if the respondents are not going to prevail, then maybe that's the least damaging way is just to pull back altogether. But that just doesn't sound quite like Justice Kagan's normal attitude on these issues. I also wanted to say that I don't know how my remarks have come across as to whether I think one side or the other is going to win. I generally think that the supporters of the town came out slightly, probably more optimistic than the supporters of the respondents. But I mean, you know, the swing vote here likely is to be Justice Kennedy. And as in, I remember coming out of Levy Weissman thinking that the school district was going to win. So I don't want to come across as at all saying it's obvious that one side or the other is going to win. It was a tough argument for all three advocates.
I wonder if we could get a coalition of Thomas, Kagan, Breyer, Ginsburg, and Sotomayor and come out with a result that nobody predicted.
Well, I guess that's possible. I assume Justice Thomas will stay with Scalia, Alito, and Roberts, but it is possible.
Once again, if you have a question for our expert, we're talking to Kim Colby about today's oral argument in the Town of Greece case. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question pending at this point. Let's go to our next caller.
Going into this argument, my thinking was, however it came out, the court majority or plurality wouldn't say anything about the Lemon test, wouldn't say anything about the endorsement test. And if the ruling goes in favor of the town of Greece, the only words concerning the coercion test is that there's not coercion here.
Mm-hmm.
There's simply nonconformity.
Right.
I wonder if anything was said during argument that would suggest how they might go in that regard.
I will answer very tentatively on that. But, I mean, it's interesting, the words reasonable observer I don't think came up in the argument. It was also interesting that the SG specifically said they were not making a coercion argument. They were just arguing history and Marsh. Now, of course, the town was making an argument for a coercion test. And it's, you know, it is very possible that I think you're probably right that they're going, we'll probably see a majority opinion that talks in terms of coercion but says this doesn't meet that standard and will not try to come up with a broad coercion test overall. But that's just a guess on my part.
We've still got one more question pending at this point. Push the star button and the pound button if you'd like to be next. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, Kim. This is Carissa Mulder. I was just wondering, do you think that if the Supreme Court rules against the town, will they try to distinguish Marsh in some way, or will they overturn it completely?
Well, I think they would distinguish it.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was pretty much consensus among the few people I talked to afterwards that we had not heard anything that suggested Marsh itself was in danger from a majority. You know, I don't know what Justice Kagan and Justice Sotomayor might do, given their line of questioning about the court's opening itself. So I don't anticipate Marsh itself being overruled, and of course that's a positive from the town's perspective. I do think that there are ways to distinguish Marsh. I don't think they're very satisfactory, and at the end of the day, I didn't get the feeling that Justice Kennedy was in agreement with them. And that would be that the town board has this adjudicatory function that, in theory, Congress and the state legislatures do not have, and that somehow taints what is happening at the town board meetings such that they can't open with prayer in order to have this equality of citizens. Justice Kagan, I should say, actually had a very eloquent statement somewhere toward the end of the respondent's argument in which she went on that theme of, you know, when we come before government boards that are making decisions about our lives, we should not have, we should all be equal and there as Americans, not there as, you know, Jewish, Muslim, or Christian. And so, you know, I think there might be a couple of votes for getting rid of Marsh. I don't know. But I do think there are grounds that a majority of justices could use to distinguish Marsh and still strike down the prayer. I don't think those grounds are that persuasive. And as I think I said earlier, Breyer probably outlined an opinion that maybe would strike down the prayer or uphold it. I couldn't really tell which way he was going with it, but that would just come up with this two-part test where you have to have a rotation and much more diversity among prayer givers, and the prayer givers have to be given some guidance to have more inclusive prayers.
As a follow-up on the rotation part, wouldn't that be very difficult in a community like Town of Greece, where there may not be many people outside of particular religious groups even who live
right
there and may not be volunteering, even if you go and track down every person within a 30-mile radius or something of that nature?
Well, right. Town of Greece, you know, says we do have
yeah
rotation.
Yes.
And it's not our fault that our community tends to be Christian. We've allowed whoever wants to sign up to be a prayer giver to do so, and we've had the Jewish person, the Baha'i person, and the Wiccan person doing that to show our good faith. And of course, the respondents say, but it's overwhelmingly Christian, and there is some, the respondents go into the facts a bit, calling into question whether this rotation really has been done in good faith, but since they didn't appeal the argument that there was any sort of intentional discrimination in the choice of prayer givers,
mm-hmm,
they did not appeal that from the district court to the Second Circuit. That's not on the table, you know, for the Supreme Court, I assume. So that's one. And then, interestingly, the respondents themselves made a point in the argument today of saying rotation doesn't work for us either. And one of the reasons was that they said that minority people who give prayers often tend to get hate mail.
Okay.
And so they're kind of suppressed that way. And then the other was what I already mentioned, which is people going to town meetings tend to just go to one or two, and so they're still only hearing the one prayer.
Yes. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
We make a last call for questions. If you have a question for our expert, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And let me ask you a question, if I could. I'm going to make sure I understand the adjudicatory function argument that was going on in the courtroom. Was there anybody tying that into Lee versus Weissman and its coercion test? I mean, were they saying
yeah
that, explicitly saying that you're subjecting yourselves to this, as citizens, to this adjudicatory function, and you're coerced to the extent you need to pray when their endorsed prayer is being offered?
Right. Sotomayor, Kagan, and Ginsburg definitely made that argument, and they made it very strongly and repeatedly, which is in this particular setting, and this was made very strongly by respondents in their briefs, it's actually, in a way, their main coercion argument, which is you are standing there or sitting there, the meeting starts, you're asked to engage in prayer, or, you know, whether you really are or not, one of the big questions here. But the people who are about to decide whether you get your business permit are going to see whether you participate in the prayer or not. So, of course, you want to make them like you, and so therefore you're going to go along with bowing your head or standing or whatever it
right
is. And of course, that leads into the whole Levi Wiseman issue of whether is just standing respectfully while other people pray, is that coercion? And of course, Justice Kennedy said it was for children in the graduation context.
Right. Well, it looks like we're out of questions. Well, actually, here's one more question. So let's go to what could be our final question.
Thank you for your excellent summary and your insightful ideas on this. I have trouble getting my head around the word establishment. Now, I can go to a meeting in Canada and they can sing the Canadian National Anthem or pray for the Queen's health 1,000 times, and it's not going to make me a Canadian. I can observe any number of prayers from other denominations and other faiths, and it doesn't coerce me. I don't feel coerced in the least, let alone if I were to go out and establish a new religion. It seems like that's a pretty weak way to establish a religion. Could you comment?
Well, this was a big part of the petitioner's brief, which really was not, I mean, it was present during the argument, but it wasn't gone into in a lot of detail. But they are asking for a coercion test. They are saying we should return to what was the meaning of establishment at the founding, in their view. Which was that the government was not to tax people in order to support a particular faith, and the government was not to compel people to attend religious exercises of a particular faith. And I think, I'm trying to remember, but I think that's, basically the core components that petitioners have put forth for coercion, and that's probably what invited Justice Kagan's very strong opening hypothetical of, are you saying it's not coercion? I mean, she didn't say it in these words, but is it not coercion for the court to open with a very robustly Christian prayer? But it will be interesting to see if the court rules in favor of coercion, the coercion tests and upholds the prayer, the degree to which they outline that test, and whether they go back to what some would say is more in line with the original meaning of the Establishment Clause.
Thank you.
Well, I think now we've exhausted all the questions from the audience, but before we adjourn, we've got a couple minutes left. Let me give you an opportunity to wrap up or express any final thoughts you might want to express.
I've just been very grateful for this opportunity. I think it's exciting to see the court engage in this issue as vigorously as they did today. And it was encouraging because it was clear that the justices had absorbed the briefs. They understood, I think, what the main arguments were and the main weaknesses of both sides. And I think they gave the advocates a very fair chance to present their case. So I think we're going to see good opinions coming out of this. Again, I don't want to claim that one side or the other clearly came out of this winning, but it was a really good oral argument, and I think as a result we'll see some very good deliberative opinions.
Terrific. Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, let me thank you, Kim Colby, for being with us today and, of course, for attending oral argument earlier today. We certainly appreciate your time on both fronts. To our audience, I encourage you to join us for our teleforum conference call tomorrow at noon. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.